Welcome to Luck is Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. For over 15 years, people across southern Oregon have been living with the specter of the Jordan Cove LNG export facility and Pacific Connector gas pipeline haunting their lives. Tens of thousands of people have raised their voices in opposition to this project, which threatens hundreds of rivers and streams, forests and wetlands, the homes and property of 240 landowners, and the livelihoods of countless people across the region. On November 21, 2019, 1,000 people protested outside and inside the Oregon State Capitol. Nearly 100 landowners, tribal members, and activists staged a sit-in in Governor Kate Brown's office. Then 21 people were eventually arrested. Today we talk with two of the people who were arrested that night, Sandy Lyons from Douglas County and Emma Morris from Klamath Falls. Emma recently wrote an article for High Country News called "We Went to Jail for Our Granddaughters." Sandy and Emma, welcome to Locus Focus.
Great to be here.
Hey, Barbara. Nice to be here.
Before we get to November 21st and maybe back 15 years of the whole course of this very strange process of having this, particularly the pipeline, come and go, die and be rebirthed again, I wanted to talk about what has happened in the last week, because there's been some interesting developments. So do one of you want to start up by describing just what's happened with the contentious Department of State Lands removal fill permit, which is one of the state-required permits that Jordan Cove needs if they're going to build the pipeline and dredge Coos Bay in order to build the LNG facility?
The company, Pembina, had asked for an extension. They wanted more time on to give more information to the agency. And the agency said, no, we're not going to give you an extension. You've already had plenty of time. So shortly after that happened, the company withdrew their application for this permit. My guess, I'm not an expert, but my guess is that they saw the writing on the wall that that they were going to get denied. So that's a huge win, you know, for the Bay, for the commercial fishing industry, for the impact of landowners, for public safety, for the climate. It isn't over, though, yet, because they could potentially reapply. So we're celebrating, but cautiously.
That sounds familiar. Actually, in the documentary that I just finished, Holding the Thin Green Line, there was another point where people were celebrating cautiously, and that was when FERC denied for the second time the permit back at the end of 2016. And, of course, what happened was Donald Trump became president and has a new FERC, and FERC is now proceeding again. So I just wanted to talk a bit about what it's like to live with this up and down of you think it's over, and then it comes back to bite us again. Or as one of the photographs I was looking at this past weekend, the zombie pipeline, which keeps lifting its ugly head.
That sure is how I feel about it. Yeah, it was... When FERC denied it last time around, you know, we were foolish enough to break out the champagne and think that was it. But boy, we've learned that was the wrong approach. And so with this withdrawal, they haven't withdrawn the FERC permitting. It's still going to be decided middle of next month. So no celebrating here, but hoping and ready to fight some more.
Well, let's talk about the logistics. Now, I've had some interesting conversations with people kind of all over the region in the last week about what this means. And one friend who just, his only connection is he has a friend who actually works for Pembina, who he's actually very much opposed to Jordan Cove, but he happens to be working for them. And he sort of has been giving my friend some inside dope periodically on what's going on. So my friend has a sense without really knowing what's happening. And his theory the other night was that Pembina probably won't reapply for the DSL permit, but that they're going to litigate, and partly is to litigate, and the other one is to hope that there'll be some case made for federal priority over state regulations, and basically that if it's state versus the feds went out. So I'm just wondering if that's something that you're talking about in your groups.
We certainly are.
Yeah, I mean,
are.
One thing. Yeah.
Well, one at a time. Let's start with Emma.
Well, the governor has made it clear that Pembina cannot avoid the state process, and although we wish she would come out more strongly against this project, we are really glad that she's made it clear that her agencies will continue to fight for the right of the states to, you know, have authority over their own clean water and their own clean air. So I think that if the federal government tries to preempt Oregon in this matter, Oregon's going to push back pretty strongly.
I mean, I've been running these scenarios in my head. I stay up at night thinking about this and like how it can play out. And it seems like so much is going to be dependent on who is elected president next November, actually, because it seems like this can be delayed maybe for 8 months, 10 months. But if we have another 4 years of Donald Trump and his fossil fuel administration, it seems like it may be harder. And I'm wondering what your concerns are about what the challenges are if we are faced with the same administration, same political climate coming out of D.C. that we've had for the last 3 years.
It certainly would be nicer if we got a Democrat in office. I think that would make the fight easier. But I think we can still prevail even if Donald Trump is elected by asserting the rights of the states to, you know, be in charge of their own environment, and then by having these permits decided correctly by the state agencies, and by just keeping up the public pressure the way that we have been, making it clear that this is not something that Oregonians want. So I think even though it'll be a harder road if Trump's reelected, I still think we can win.
Okay, that'll be a conversation for another time down the line. We'll be talking about keeping Trump from being reelected. But in the meantime, I kind of want to go back. I'd like to go back as long as you guys have been involved in the struggle. Sandy, let's talk a bit about your story, because I heard a snippet of you describing to Governor Brown when you were sitting in her office on November 21st about why you are so invested in stopping this pipeline. So why don't you share that with us?
Okay. Well, I'm very invested for many reasons that Emma agrees with, too, but certainly the whole frack gas going abroad, but I'll leave that. You know that. The stance I've taken and feel able to speak to is the effect on the environment in the streams. So my husband and I moved here bought the place in 1990 when I was pregnant with our only son. And we wanted to raise him in a rural environment, learn the land, and we did. We bought this place and we moved here, and we discovered that there were no fish in this one stream that is ideal for coho spawning. And we started restoration work, and we've been doing restoration work for 30 years. So that we've lived here. So 15 years in, we got this notice that a pipeline was proposed to come right through. At the time, it was to come right through our house. When they came out and looked at that, they go, oh, no. So they moved it down through the creek. And it just is so wrong on so many levels. We've restored that creek. We now have coho spawning here. And it's not, I speak to Fate Creek, the creek on our property, but it crosses over 200 streams and rivers if it were to be put in. So I really am speaking for the fish and the all aquatic creatures that are living in these beautiful creeks and in rivers in Oregon. And it's just heartbreaking to think of it coming through our place, but coming through every one of those. So that's been my main speaking point, because that's what I live every day.
Well, your story reminded me of when I talked to the Klamath tribes back in last March when I was working on my documentary. And they speak about they've been working on salmon restoration forever, basically since the dams were put in the Klamath River back in 2017. And they got an agreement with FERC back, I think, in 2006, that it was cheaper. The dams had to be relicensed, and it was cheaper for them to basically take out the dams than it was to put the required fish ladders in, which they had promised to put in 2017. And Taylor Tupper said very powerfully, she said, there's no way in hell that we are going to let this company put a pipeline in and destroy all the work we've done to bring back the salmon in our river. And I mean, that's a big river compared to your little creek, but I think it's all the same story of people who've been really working hard. And the tribes, they have such a long history here, so much longer than any of us who are not indigenous, that it seems to me, you look at that viewpoint versus this viewpoint of Pembina and all their predecessors who've owned this project. So I want to talk a bit about the difference in that relationship to land between like you on your little creek and the Klamath tribes on the Klamath River and its tributaries, and Pembina's view, your world views, basically, how do they differ?
In my mind, not much. When I met some of the tribal members, I spoke as a steward of the land. We don't feel we own this land. It was tribal land previously, and we just feel honored to be here trying to restore it and keep it the way it should be for a salmon habitat. And I was honored to meet Thomas Joseph in Salem, and just was so impressed by what he's done and stood up for, and I think we just bonded instantly, and I feel I've made a lifelong friend. So I don't claim to have the heritage that the tribe has by any means, but in a small sense, I feel what they're going through and have so much better understanding of their pain.
Well, the other part of my question, though, is also comparing. I see definitely you and the tribes have a very similar worldview. How does that contrast with the worldview that you are feeling imposed on you by Pembina?
I'm not sure I totally understand that, but they're taking our land, they're taking their land. It's a new experience for us and not for them, but am I getting toward what you
Yeah, well, asking? Actually, I mean, I guess I'm just, I try to understand, like, how a company like Pembina can just come in and not just ravage private properties, and that's not a question of private properties, not even just a question of tribal property, because the tribes don't really believe in private property, but it has to do with a way of, to me, it's a major disrespect of the planet Earth, of life. But I wonder how you feel, because you're taking it so personally. How do you feel, or how do you see this force that's coming at you that has such a different set of values than what you're trying to protect?
it's the zombies, for sure. That they could come in, not only draw a line across our property and say, this is where it's going, and we're going to pull out the structures you placed for salmon habitat, but take our pasture for a staging area, you just feel totally trampled on and unable to have any power at all.
And it's the short-term viewpoint of it that's really so shocking to me. You know, I mean, I don't think there's anybody even in Pembina who believes that fossil fuels aren't going to be going away. We are, you know, we're shifting away from fossil fuels on a global scale. And so basically what they're trying to do is just make a little bit more money on the tail end. And just to do that, they're willing to cut this 100-foot wide slash all the way through the entire state of Oregon, just ripping up whatever is in their way, just to drain the last few drops of profit out of the fossil fuel business. It's just such short-term thinking. It just really is depressing.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and in Seattle on KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM. And today we're talking with Sandy Lyons from Douglas County and Emma Maris from Klamath Falls, who were arrested for sitting in at Governor Brown's office on November 21st of last year. Well, let's talk about why you decided that you needed to sit in at the governor's office. And I'll start with Emma. Now, Emma, let's talk a bit about your background first, because you don't live out on a large piece of land like Sandy does, or like a lot of the other landowners do. You live in Klamath Falls. So why do you feel so personal about this pipeline and this LNG facility, which is actually, the LNG facility is probably almost as far from you as it is from Portland, but why do you feel that it's so important for you to stand up against it?
Well, I'm an environmental writer, and I've been writing about environmental issues for about 15 years. So I'm extremely concerned about the larger issue of climate change, obviously. And I felt I initially got involved because I felt this was a way that I could tackle a large chunk of emissions, but in my own backyard in a local way. The reports have shown that this project would cause something like 40 million tons of carbon dioxide every year. So I thought, great, I'll get involved in stopping this. It's something I can do and have some personal stake in. But as I learned more about the opposition of the tribes and landowners like Sandy, I came to see it as larger than just climate. It becomes an issue of Oregonians and tribal nations' rights to their own land and their own environment. And And so, yeah, I got pretty passionate about fighting this. And it's true, I live in town, I live not far away from the Klamath River where it would cross under.
I was talking to Allie Rosenbluth, who's with Real Climate, and she was talking about this place called Al Farm, which is the Oregon Women's Land Trust in Day's Creek. And I imagine it's not that far from you, Sandy, is that true?
It's just over the hill.
Yeah, and I used to hang out there a lot in the 70s and in the 80s, and the last time I was down there was in the early 90s. And so when I learned that this particular piece of land, which I could visualize so well, was being impacted by the pipeline, it no longer was an abstraction of, I mean, I'd been on some of the landowner's land and stuff, but there was something about something, a piece of land that I'd known for 45 years. And then I started really getting just what this means to all of Oregon, and even for those of us who live in Northern Oregon, having the southern half of our state just desecrated that way struck me. It became much more personal to me. And I wonder if you, when you start making connections with people in other parts of the state, if you find ways to connect, find that resonance with people so people understand this is an attack on the entire state. Actually, I think it's an attack on the entire planet, but just as Oregonians, how it affects us.
Absolutely.
Yeah, when I talk to people about it, I usually show maps of where, you know, where it would go. And people say, oh, well, that's where I, you know, go mushroom hunting, or, oh, I know that piece of land. Or so, yeah, it makes it really tangible for people.
Yeah, actually, I remember when the DEQ hearings were going on in, was it two summers ago in Medford, and I got an email from Regna Merritt, who was at that time with Physicians for Social Responsibility, and they were getting the last pitch of comments. And I guess it was going to be a big rally when they were turning in the comments. And she was saying, well, if you just happen to be in Southern Oregon for vacation, you know, come to this rally. And I thought, a lot of people in Northern Oregon do spend a lot of time in Southern Oregon. So I feel like this has been an opportunity for us to connect as a state. One of the things that's really stunning to me about the movement against Jordan Cove is how it crosses so many political and social and economic and cultural lines. So let's talk a bit about who some of your comrades are in this struggle and how differences find common ground.
It has been interesting to bring together Republicans, Democrats, whatever your lean is, to come together to fight this pipeline. And these are neighbors and friends, and some have become better friends now because of a mutual need to fight this. Bill Gow, who I'm sure you've heard speak numerous times, speaks out on how disturbed he is about people not understanding the use of eminent domain to take his family land. And I wouldn't have known Bill Gow except for meeting him at rallies and such. And we come together and fight this together.
Let's talk a bit more about Bill Gow. I mean, I actually met him for the first time. I talked to him on the phone a few times, but didn't get an opportunity to meet him until the rally on November 21st. But Bill Gow is an interesting character. Let's a little talk about his background and his politics and why it's so stunning that he's like making such a strong alliance with his neighbor across the highway, Stacey McLaughlin.
Right. Stacey McLaughlin, yeah, I was at a rally at one of the hearings, and Stacey gets up and says, you know, Bill and I can't usually talk, you know, but we don't talk politics anymore, but we're solid together against this. And Bill comes up and says the same thing. You know, he's staunch Republican, and it's the fact that Republicans won't stand up against this and actually support it, it just infuriates him.
Well, actually, I understand that he did not vote for Newt Bueller in the last gubernatorial election. I think he voted for Kate. Because, I mean, and that's what's kind of interesting is watching people who have been staunch Republicans and are watching what's happening and how it's impacting them personally. I understand the same thing's happening like in Wisconsin and Michigan also. But I just wonder, have you had any conversations with Bill where he's talked about maybe changing a little bit about some of his worldview?
No, I haven't. I've only had the opportunity to meet him at rallies, but I have talked a little with Clarence Adams, who has switched from being a Republican and is actually registering as a Democrat, I believe, and is supporting people who are fighting the pipeline.
Well, my friend Eric plays up at Sightline Institute in Seattle. He says this thing, which, you know, when people like you are in this thick of this fight, might not be able to quite grapple with, but he says he loves these fossil fuel fights because it brings communities together in ways that they would never be together, and it really transforms them and moves them in very progressive and very humanistic ways. And I mean, I think about there's no bigger example of that, I think, than what's been going on in Southern Oregon. And I'm kind of curious, and 15 years ago when this started, there was not the same movement that there is now. And I'm wondering how you felt as you've watched the kind of dynamics of this struggle really change and so many more people become involved.
It was very, very difficult in the beginning. We felt very alone. There were no networks out there at all, and we didn't know how to take this huge corporation on as just a little farmer here on our land. So we did the hearings, we did what we could, and started meeting people at the hearings and at rallies, small groups formed. But I've got to say the piece that really helped me the most and brought us together was Rogue Climate hiring a person to interface with the landowners.
And who's that person?
That person was Maya Jarrod.
Yeah, she's an amazing woman.
She's an incredible woman, and she and Rogue Climate pulled off amazing things, being able to turn out people for hearings. The hearing in Canyonville for the DSL, when Vicki actually came and faced us all.
And that's Vicki Walker, who's the head of the Department
Walker,
of State Lands.
Yeah. Yes, and Maya and her crew turned out thousands of people at these hearings. And got, 49,000 people to write in? This wasn't happening in the past. So I kind of wonder if it isn't, you know, having someone really managing it like that. Because Maya kept us informed of what was happening, where we just had to, you know, read the newspaper and try to find out it was coming to us. And she was invited me to come up to that rally, and I was pretty rallied out. You know, I'd been to numerous rallies, and nothing had been accomplished but standing there and taking pictures. And but when Rogue Climate and their fellow organizations got into this, they made things happen. I'm incredibly grateful to them.
Well, actually,
that's how I met Emma.
Yeah. We'll get to that story because that's a very beautiful story, which Emma tells very well in the article that you wrote for High Country News recently. One of the things, I mean, I've been talking to Jody McCaffrey on this show for several years, maybe 10, It's been interesting. It's been sometimes really painful watching her go through all these different periods of burnout, which she felt like she was the only person doing it. And when I finally met her last March and interviewed her and stayed with her for a while, and she was talking about there's young people getting involved now. There's new energy. And she's recognizing, I think more than she used to, she's recognizing this is not just her. And I've been to a couple hearings in Coos Bay where she was surrounded by people in red shirts, many of them much younger than her, who are bringing this new energy. And Rogue Climate is the name that keeps coming up. And it is, my impression about Rogue Climate is basically it's pretty young people that are involved in that. And there are people like Allie Rosenbluth who came from fighting LNG on the East Coast as well. So there's, they bring a very interesting set of skills. And I wonder what it's like to be interfacing with all these young people who are maybe taking your struggle in ways that you might not have known how to do it before.
It's amazing because they're very educated people that know the techniques. That when I was in school, I never thought of learning or having classes in. And being young and energetic and feeling positive that something could be done, we're feeling pretty beaten down. And it goes on and on and on. And they come in and say, fight. We can affect this. You can do it. And they're a great group. And I've got a second. Jody McCaffrey is an amazing person that
yes.
She's hung in there and the knowledge she has. She certainly, we were in her network, has helped us all understand. But the fresh young people are awesome. You know, if you looked around you at the rally, it was all ages of people there.
In fact, I think that when I went to the rally in November, I feel like it's one of the broadest representations of age groups that I've ever been to at any rally. Even more so than the climate marches that the youth have been organizing all around the state, all around the world for the last year or so. And they're also, I mean, it still feels like this. It still, in some ways, reflects the lack of ethnic diversity in Oregon. But certainly, the tribes are really involved and have a very strong presence. And in fact, my sense about the Jordan Cove movement is that it's really led by the tribes and by young people. Is that a correct impression?
I would certainly say.
Yeah, that sounds
so.
Right.
So, how does that feel? I kind of want to get both of you. I understand, Emma, you're quite a bit younger than Sandy. Is that correct?
No, I'm in my 40s. And
you're just a youngster, you know?
I'm in my 70s.
Right.
I still feel that youthful energy. I mean, to fully disclose, I'm now on the board of Rogue Climate. I think they're just a really wonderful organization that's just done so much with such, on a shoestring with just little tiny bit of resources and a lot of energy. And they have definitely created a community, helped catalyze a community here in Klamath that didn't exist before. I just this week I ran into a local landowner in the grocery store, and we started talking about what we're going to do once we've beaten this pipeline with the community that we've created. You know, what kind of cool, positive, renewable energy or energy efficiency projects are we going to take on? So they've actually created a whole community here in town that didn't exist before, just by being that kind of node that we could all come together around. It's really amazing.
Yeah, that's Eric DePlace's. That's why he loves fossil fuel projects, because it builds community. Klamath Falls is an interesting place. I haven't been there, because I drove through by accident a few months ago. But other than that, I haven't been there. I spent much time there in a really long time. And my sense of it was a pretty conservative, pretty isolated community back when I was there more in the early 90s. I'm curious about how it feels now. What kinds of transformation that you've seen since you've been living there, Emma?
Well, it's definitely still a conservative community. Yeah, we still have, I think something like twice as many registered Republicans as Democrats here. But we do have a pretty active group of more progressive individuals who are really interested in making it a better place to live and creating some cool jobs in the renewable energy sector. And we have a lot of big ideas and a lot of energy. So, and we, because we live here, we have to learn how to get along with our neighbors and work together with them to make some of these cool projects happen, because things like, good new jobs are pretty bipartisan issues. So, it's still a red county for sure, but there's stuff going on here that makes me really hopeful for our future.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locust Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM. And we're talking today with Emma Maris, who's an environmental writer from Klamath Falls, and Sandy Lyons, a landowner in Douglas County. And they were both arrested for sitting in at Governor Brown's office on November 21st of this past year. So let's talk about why you decided that you needed to sit in the governor's office to make your point. What was not happening for you that you needed to take what for some of you was probably a pretty radical and new direction? Let's start with you, Sandy.
It certainly was a new direction for me. I think I had one traffic ticket in my 20s and never been arrested before. So it was scary, but I went for the rally and the sit-in, and the rally was so uplifting to see such a group of people come together and to be in a group of people that totally supported you, that it was just inspiring. And so I decided to go up for the sit-in, and even more so there as we sat for 8 hours or 9 hours talking to each other. I never felt so supported before. And I'm not a speaker, and I had a really tough time speaking, and the people just totally supported me. And that was a new feeling for me. If you don't mind my going back just a little, Douglas County is really difficult because of the job issue that's being pushed. So rather than this bringing us together. I feel like it's really split us apart more. It's brought landowners together, but the division of which side are you on is painful, really painful. And the pipeline just says, we're going to offer all these jobs. And you know the truth of it is there'll be a few jobs during construction, and they've said 16 jobs at the terminal, and those won't necessarily be local folks. So I just
and the terminal's in Coos Bay. I mean, that's like 80 miles west of you, right?
Right. Yeah. So the divisiveness going on in our county is just painful, and to be in Salem with these folks that were so supportive. All ages, all backgrounds, not just the landowner. And they weren't not in my backyard kind of thing, which I'm afraid maybe I come across as, so I care so much more than my backyard. So it was just an awesome experience. And after sitting in, you'll probably get to that, what made us decide to stay after the sit-in.
Actually, I'm curious, when you went to the rally, you didn't even plan initially on going into the governor's office?
I thought I would maybe go into the governor's office. You know, I wasn't sure how far I would be able to go. And once I met these people and was supported so by them, there was no question I would go to the sit-in. I still wasn't positive about being arrested. That was a really big thing for me. Something so much unknown, and it was intimidating. And but people speaking there, Emma and all the people spoke to why they were there, and then Thomas Joseph spoke and talked about Standing Rock and how he'd been arrested. I thought, oh, geez, you know, why can't I do this if these people can do it with much higher risk to themselves?
Now, did people intend to be arrested when they went in? I can answer that question myself because I got a little glimmer beforehand from a friend who was going down. She said to be support, so I knew something was going to be happening. But I was wondering how much people were preparing to be arrested and how much people were just wanting to make a statement. People, I have a photograph, actually, of people sitting in front of Kate Brown's office a couple years ago in this process. But this was seemed to be on a whole different higher stake. And I'm wondering why people were taking it another step before, rather than just sitting in front of her office, actually going in and then deciding to actually stay.
Well, we
I think that there was
been
a sense that we wanted to be prepared for different eventualities. You know, we just wanted to let the day play out in a way that felt safe and a way that felt like we were getting our message across. So, you know, there was a lot of discussion of different possibilities, but we didn't pre-plan anything to the point where we knew exactly what was going to happen. We had to be able to be flexible as the day unfolded.
Now, as
we hoped that she would agree with us, and we would have walked out. We
right.
went hoping to achieve what we had asked for, and that she would take on the pipeline and terminal. But she didn't, and then we were sitting there going, well, we just said we're going to sit here until she does. Do we leave or do we stay? And it seemed like we had to stay, or else what were we standing by what we'd said?
Let's talk a bit about actually what kind of response you gave when she came in after how many hours that you've been sitting there.
I think we were there for eight. Yeah, and then she had called us over, so she had a staff member there who was talking to us. And at some point in the afternoon, she called us over speakerphone, and Thomas Joseph had a conversation with her. And basically said, please, can you come out against this project? And she sort of hemmed and hawed and had her excuses. So that didn't resolve anything, so we continued to stay in her office. And then around 8 o'clock, we suddenly got notice that she was coming herself. And so then she came in and we spoke with her. We sort of, several of us each sort of made our pleas to her in person. I was very nervous to talk to her. And again, unfortunately, she wasn't prepared. She wasn't ready yet to come out against this project. So then she left. And then it was sort of time to make decisions, because then at that point we were told that we had to leave or risk arrest.
So what was it like getting arrested?
You know, I really, I'm almost embarrassed to say how nervous I was, because I know, I mean, part of the reason that I decided to put myself in that position is I wanted to be able, as a middle class, you know, middle-aged white mom, I wanted to be able to use my privilege for the greater good. And so I knew that the cops would treat us pretty well. But I was nevertheless kind of terrified the whole time. it's just such an unfamiliar thing. I've never been arrested before either. So, it was a very methodical process. There were 21 of us. We sat down on the carpet, and then they started arresting us one by one, very slowly. It took hours.
When they arrested you, did you feel threatened? Did you feel like they were trying to humiliate you, or did you feel like they were being respectful?
I felt they were doing their job. You know, every 15 minutes, I think maybe that's part of why they do it slowly. Every 15 minutes, one of the officers stood in front of us and read the same statement that, if we leave, please leave now. I think at any point we could have still left and not been arrested. So I think they were trying to get some of us to leave and have to fewer of us to deal with.
Did anybody leave, or were the 21
no.
that there was? So you, there were 21 of you who decided you were going to stay at
yep,
the point
right.
where they okay.
Yeah, and we none of us broke, and we sat there and talked and bonded even further. And maybe you could describe, Emma, we sang to each person as they left, and that was really supportive for me. They take you, I was went before Emma, and as you, they take you out in the hall, and they put their little plastic ties tightly on your arm, and then walk you down the hall and down the stairs, and you could hear the group in there singing, "Sandy, you are my friend." Huh. And it was so touching. The songs throughout the day were so touching and supportive.
Yeah, well, it was amazing. As you probably could hear it while you were in the office, but people were singing "We've Got the Power" in the rotunda for, like, I recorded the whole thing. It was over 10 minutes long, and it was amazing. I mean, it was amazing to be in there. What did it feel like to be in the office, in the governor's office, hearing close to 1,000 people singing to you?
It was so strong. The acoustics were beautiful, how it came up and echoed into the room. And we were kind of afraid to step out on the balcony to look down on all this because they might lock the door behind us. So we stayed in the room that felt so elevated by the sound of all those people. Then when I saw the pictures later, just gave me goosebumps how many people were supporting.
It was really magical.
Once you were arrested, I mean, how did they treat you?
A robot, I guess. You know, it was just, we were a number to be processed. They took us off the bus one at a time and searched us and took everything away from us. But, you know, they were fine. They didn't mistreat us in any way.
No strip searches or anything like that?
No, I mean, on the contrary, I really feel like our sort of white activist privilege was really in full effect. I mean, at one point, they left our cell door unlocked so we could use the bathroom if we wanted to.
That's pretty unusual.
You know, that's the kind of thing that doesn't happen to people of color who get arrested. So
right.
I think that, you know, we were treated actually pretty well.
Well, that's good to hear. And then the other thing that's interesting is that shortly after you were charged, what happened?
Well, it didn't feel shortly. We were there till about 5 a.m. And then we were released, and some friends of ours came and got us. So we were there long enough to say that we spent the night in jail.
What's interesting, though, is that what happened to the charges?
So they decided against pressing charges. So we had a date, a court date, that we were all going to have to meet up back in Salem. But before that date came, the county decided not to press charges. And I don't want to speculate on why they made that decision. It may have been because they didn't want any further publicity about this.
Huh. So you don't think that Kate had anything to do with that?
Well, it could have been. I don't know. I don't.
You don't want to speculate?
Yeah.
I won't make you speculate on the air then.
It would be nice to think she did. But
I mean, it made me very hopeful in a way, because I thought the fact that the charges got dropped so fast was an indication that there was some kind of political machination going on.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I know that, you know, we were really excited that there was press coverage of the event, of the rally, of the sit-in, and that some of this press coverage spread beyond the borders of Oregon. And that's really part of the reason, you know, we wanted to really try to change Kate Brown's mind, but we also wanted to let more people know about this project. Some people have in Oregon haven't even heard about it.
I think you changed things. I mean, it was actually getting international coverage. I was really surprised. I've been going through Googling photographs of this whole event. And when I see some of the publications that have had photographs and articles about it, it was so widespread. And I just wonder, like, what kind of response that you had to seeing the kind of coverage that you got.
Sandy, you want to take that one?
Yeah, it ended up getting a lot more coverage in Douglas County because the headline the next weekend was front page covered, Douglas County woman arrested in Salem. And it was just sort of mind-boggling to me that, oh, that was me. So there have been numerous articles, and Emma's writings have gone New York Times and Oregonian and High Country News. And so off of it, there's come a lot more public knowledge and awareness. So painful at times, but it's brought more and more attention that I hope is beneficial.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX FM. And today we're talking with Sandy Lyons from Douglas County and Emma Morris from Klamath Falls, and they're both arrested for sitting in at Governor Brown's office on November 21st of the past year. Well, I wanted to talk for the rest part of the show about you guys' relationship, because you didn't know each other when you both sat in.
No, yeah, we did not.
So let's talk about how you got to know each other and what happened in the course of that 8 hours that you were sitting in the governor's office.
Well, I noticed Emma immediately when she appeared at the rally and came upstairs, because she was well-dressed in a red blazer and bright red lipstick, and she has red hair. So Emma stood out as someone I wanted to know more about.
Emma, did you dye your hair so you can be all in red?
No, my hair is always red. But I did actually buy that tube of lipstick that morning, because I looked in the mirror and I thought, you know, that I could do more red here. Red is the official sort of no LNG color, so I thought I would punch it up.
So as you were saying, Sandy,
there's more story to the red lipstick too, because it, what, 5 in the morning, we were all laughing, and someone said to Emma, your lipstick's still staying on. she had told us that it was a 24-hour lipstick, so it was a cool story. But
so anyway, so you noticed her immediately.
So we kind of buddied up so that we'd have someone to go through this with. And Emma and I became buddies, looking out for each other. And when she would be the first person to speak, then I kind of toddled up behind her and managed to speak too. So then over the course of the evening, we chatted about so much and just really, I think, became friends and felt each other.
Well, it's a very intense way to meet somebody. I mean, I that really is one of the things that impressed me. Emma wrote this really wonderful story that was High Country News about this, about the sit-in and about you guys' relationship before you were arrested. And Emma, I want to talk about, like, what drew you to Sandy, and like what kind of specialness you started feeling as you were getting to know her over the course of those hours.
Well, the first time I heard Sandy tell her story about her stream, she started to tear up, and I just thought, my gosh, you know, this woman has been fighting this for so many years, and it still breaks her heart every time she thinks about what might happen to her stream and to her salmon. And that just really made me feel emotional. And so I was interested in her as a character and as a friend. So then when we buddied up, we started looking out for each other. And I want to add that the whole group really did bond in this really kind of very fast way. Not only the larger group of everybody at the sit-in, we all got to know each other really fast. It's nothing like sitting in a room with somebody for 8 hours without, anything else to do but talk. That really kind of accelerates that. And then the 21 of us just became, sort of instantly bonded through our experiences. You know, by the time 5 o'clock rolled around, we had inside jokes and nicknames for each other, and it's like we've known each other for years. So yeah, these kind of experiences are sort of really intense, and everybody who was there, I feel like they're my friend,
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a big, there was a lot of love in that room, and one thing that really touched, I think, both Sandy and I was that, or Sandy and me, here I am, a writer using the wrong.
That's okay. You don't have to use correct pronouns here.
What really touched us was that a lot of us were from Southern Oregon, but there were also in that group of 21 people from Portland who weren't in the path of this pipeline and were just supporting us out of sort of general principles of sort of justice and climate solidarity. And we found that really touching, that people would come all the way down and help and be willing to put so much on the line for us, essentially. It was just extremely, we felt so supported.
Well, actually,
we've made
yeah
so many friends from that. Weekend before last, this group of 21 said they'd like to come see our property and see this stream and everything. And I said, come. And unfortunately, we picked one of the worst weather weekends in Oregon. But 6 people came from Portland. They came down and spent the night here, and then, I don't know, we had about 11, 12 people. Emma was going to come, and she got snowed in, but these people came, and we had such a good time sitting around talking, and then the next day we walked our creek, and then we went on up and looked down at Owl Ranch, and Frances Etherington was with us then and described what was happening there, and I just feel like I'm so lucky to have done that and made such good friends.
Yeah, actually, I can understand why people from Portland would want to go down. And that's one of the things I think has really changed is in the last year I've seen people in Portland really understanding why Jordan Cove is an issue for everybody and not just for people in Southern Oregon. But I think that there's another quantum leap that was made in awareness because of your arrests in November.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, and I would like to come down and see your land maybe on my next
You're
trip.
You're always welcome.
Yeah, I'll be in touch because I'll be coming down to Southern Oregon again in the near future.
All right.
So one of the things that I was struck, Emma, in your article was talking about how you were relating to Sandy being several years older than you and maybe having different needs and the way that you kind of helped her in that way. I wanted you to describe a little bit about that.
Well, Sandy's in her 70s, and it was a little rougher for you, just the whole process. The holding cell where we were kept didn't have benches or anything, just these little thin mats on the floor. And, they kept having us get up and come on out and to be processed and go back in, and getting, up and down and up and down in the middle of the night. And, of course, Sandy got a migraine because it's just this pounding fluorescent light in the jail cell that they'd never turn off. So I was really worried about her. Also, the zip tie style cuffs bruised her wrist pretty badly. So I was feeling very, I was just worried about you, Sandy, and I was hoping you were okay.
I was surviving.
And of course, the next morning, when we finally got out of there at around 5 a.m., I thought, okay, first we got to get Sandy somewhere where she can sleep and rest. And then the next morning we got together for breakfast, and I was just stunned because you looked completely transformed. You looked like you were just glowing. And I thought, oh my gosh, she recovered pretty quick.
until the migraine passed.
Yeah.
And I got a little sleep and a new perspective.
Yeah. How
and
do you
we were out.
How do you feel that this experience has really changed you, in, both in, personally and also in terms of the political work that you're doing now?
Yes, it has. There's something about being bound and unable to leave where you are that I've never experienced. You know, being locked up was harder than I realized. You know, we have such freedom in our lives that to not have that, I have a new sense for those incarcerated.
And
for me, I think it was a big watershed moment because I've made, my career has always been as a writer and often as a journalist, but I've been more and more activist over the years, and I sort of feel like there's actually going to jail is a little bit of a threshold. You can sort of can't really say, well, I'm mostly a writer. I just did. You know what I mean? I've set aside this notion of being some sort of impartial journalist because I just care too damn much. I can't pretend to be unbiased about something this vital.
Yeah, I kind of share the same way because I've been following this and ostensibly as a journalist, but I discovered when I was trying to get some interviews with some people on the other side over the last year that they, from this show, because I don't have any pretenses on this show about where I stand, that I'm persona non grata in the fossil fuel industry locally. And I thought, well, if they're not going to let me talk to them anymore, then I'm just going to be more out about the way I feel and feel better and feel more comfortable at it. And that's, I think, a really interesting threshold to cross, too, where you feel comfortable being an advocate at the same time that I'm still trying to get all the information I can and to do it in an impartial way. Do you feel like that's kind of where you're going to go with your writing from now on?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's incompatible to search for the truth with also trying to change the world for the better. I think those two activities are actually go hand in hand. And I actually feel much more free and open. I just feel better just telling people that I care deeply about the climate and this is what I think ought to be done, rather than pretending that I'm some sort of robot without opinion.
Well, I'm really looking forward to your upcoming writing, Emma, because I appreciated what I've seen since I learned your name and knew that you're going to be on this show. So I look forward to what's going to be coming in the future.
Me too. It's been amazing to know. I was told she was a writer from Klamath Falls. Okay. I've learned now what kind of writer she is.
Actually, I heard you on NPR, I think, Emma, it was last week or recently.
It was on OPB discussing an op-ed I wrote in the New York Times about how to get involved with climate activism and why I think getting involved with a group like Rogue Climate or like, you know, Oregon, you know, some of the ones up in Portland, is actually sort of a better and more healing way to try to fight for climate justice than to focus on yourself and your own footprint and trying to reduce your footprint. I think it's very noble to try to reduce your own personal footprint, but I often see a lot of people just do that and kind of get obsessive about it and not get involved in the more collective action. And so my piece was really trying to urge people to sort of start thinking more about the collective action stuff and not feel so ashamed if they can't be perfect in terms of the personal carbon emissions.
Yeah, well, I was very happy to hear you saying all that on OPB. I'm glad that they let you on. So, well, anyway, I want to thank you both for the work that you're doing and for being on the show today, and definitely want to stay in touch. And as the long and twisted journey of Jordan Cove continues, you can be part of my entourage that helps to follow that. So I look forward to talking to you again.
Likewise. Thank you for all you do.
Okay.
I wanted to say, too. Thank you for having us.
Sure. My pleasure. Thanks a lot. We've been talking today with Sandy Lyons from Douglas County and Emma Maris from Klamath Falls, who were arrested for sitting in at Governor Brown's office on November 21st of last year. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any other KBOO public affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we'll be listening to an updated version of my radio documentary, which is the second half of Holding the Thin Green Line, called The Long and Twisted Tale of Jordan Cove, and it includes footage from the demonstration November 21st, which happened after the show first aired on KBOO. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. We're going to go out with some music by Alder Manning. This is a song that she sang at the climate strike in Portland back in September. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening.
Disconnected from the trees, human touch replaced by screens. Entire species are dying, migrating climate refugees.